So, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. This is a side project that did not begin as research. There is a disclosure regarding the presentation in general, which is that Dr. Dorian, who was my partner and the person who brought me into the project, she has since essentially given up and left 20 years of her public health career after graduating from Johns Hopkins because her community called her to be a principal of one of the schools that's in this presentation. Not because of what we were doing, but because of who she is. The Armenian community is very tightly knit. They say that there's 2 degrees of separation among everyone in the community. And the collective whole, the sense of well-being for that community is very powerful for them. And she is now a principal at the school where when I first went there with her, she pointed at a wall and said, "When I was in the second grade, I chipped my tooth on that wall." And these are the same schools that her children have been going to and that everyone in her family has gone to. So it didn't begin as research. It began as an effort by a mother in the community, someone who went to one of these schools, who wanted to give back and wanted to share her knowledge, what she had learned over 20 years of her career, and also talking to other concerned parents and so forth. And that's where this started. And then we were saying, okay, how can we reverse engineer this? To maybe make it research, or the next time we do a new school, measure it properly. So unfortunately, I don't have a lot of charts and graphs. I don't know how many of you are upset by that. Okay. So most California laws and regulations do not even mention parochial schools, private schools in general. So it's a problem. There are 3 specific codes. You'll see the numbers in a moment. But they reference private schools and the need to have disaster plans, lockdown plans. Public schools have to prove what they're doing. Public schools have to, you know, there's oversight, there's, you know, some accountability. Private schools, even for those few regulations that do reference them, there's no infrastructure or mechanism for reporting. And we think that's a problem. So I'm not going to make you read these, but here are 3 of the codes. And Dr. Dorian shared these with the staff and teachers at the schools in question because she wanted them to understand, yes, you are supposed to be doing this, and you're not. And that was the first part of the battle. So I'm going to kind of skip through a little bit just because I don't want to push up against the 18 minutes too closely. I want to leave time for questions. But the reality is that the private schools truly are on their own. However, the Armenian community, for the reasons I described, does have a leg up. They have strong social cohesion within their community. They are geographically dispersed. There are 5 schools that we did, and all 5 are commuter schools. It's not like the Armenian communities are concentrated at those locations. They might be to a certain degree, but they're all commuter schools where people are coming from 5 miles away or something like that. In LA, that's really far. I just wanted to share that. In L.A., 5 miles is like, oh my goodness, that's, you know, a different sense of geography. So the Armenians also have a strong culture of resilience, which I'll talk about a little bit. I'll have a slide for each one of these things. Long-term employees. Some of the teachers at these schools were teachers when she was a child there. That goes both good and bad sometimes, and I'm sure we're all familiar with that. And the other aspect is multi-generational ties. The friends that she was in school with are now parents with children at the school going with her kids. And these communities really are the glue these schools are the glue of the community. All the other Armenian cultural organizations and political organizations and so forth are based out of and use the school facilities regularly. So it's not just about the children. It goes much more in depth than that. In terms of resilience, first, in terms of their cultural memory, there are 2 significant events that give Armenians a really strong sense of, wow, we need to be ready to handle things on our own. And they've done this in a variety of ways through their institutions with the dispersed populations. They have very strong institutions they've developed in every country that they've settled in. And the earthquake, which Dr. Dorian went to deal with the relief and recovery efforts, was a very significant and recent event for them. Similarly, in 1994, we had the Los Angeles earthquake in Northridge, and this isn't too far from two of the 5 schools. So that's the I-10 freeway. No one could get anywhere. This is one of my favorite picks. I actually used it in a different presentation as well. Yes, in L.A., there are communities where people literally ride horses down the street. It happens. And they live as far away from downtown and Hollywood as I do. And it's a completely different culture. Each one of L.A.'s communities is so much more diverse and richer than people realize. So as they settled, they set up political institutions, school institutions, and so forth. When I say they're highly political in nature, I'm not talking just about in terms of parties. You understand that. It's the internal politics of the school. But about Dr. Dorian, just to share about her story, she was called. They said, one of our most important schools needs a principal, and you're the person we want. And how these decisions get made, it's a very interesting process sometimes. So, getting buy-in was different for each one of the constituent target audiences. School administrators and staff and teachers were actually the easiest. There was a presumption, maybe, that once we were going to add something to their plate, oh, you should be doing this also on top of everything else you're doing. We didn't face that barrier. It was very surprising. Parents, there are a core group of highly interested and highly active parents that understood this and supported it, but largely the rest were just simply not interested, which was also a surprise. We actually expected more support and buy-in from the parents in general. The students were fascinating. And first of all, we wanted to make it fun and interactive. And one of the high schools that we did the program at now has a student organization for disaster training for youth. And that's also spreading as well. So the idea is, of course, catch them while they're young. The other aspect, of course, is what I was taught was the trickle-up theory. I don't know if this is the real name. It has nothing to do with the other similar-sounding one. You teach things to the children go home and say, Mommy, Mommy, look what I learned today. And that's how things migrate. I don't know what educators call it, but I was introduced to that as the trickle-up theory. So, first we had to do a significant amount of research, not just regarding the laws, but also looking at school emergency plans in the public school districts. Actually, I was asked not to share names or particular districts, but in the area, I think we have something like 70-something school districts in LA County, which is nuts as well. Yeah. I don't even want to get into that. So they were phenomenal. They went out of their way to help develop the plans that Dr. Dorian used to create this. And I got brought in to help her do the training and to help her do the implementation. But, you know, she was, you know, really the driving force. We created a template plan, something that we could then modify to each school. There were a series of meetings, a tailoring of the plan, and then there was the moment, well, how much is this going to cost us? And each school, based upon its resources and its priorities, was able to dedicate a certain amount to developing this plan and buying supplies. And this includes things like freeze-dried food and search and rescue supplies and water and also cookies and lemonade and all the other good stuff you need. So the training, the formal training for staff and teachers consisted of 7.5 hours. And here's a brief review. It starts with the very basics, and then it ends with search and rescue. And, you know, it's funny about the first question, what is a disaster? Not even the disaster sociologists have a common answer. There are thematically like three main themes of what is a disaster, but they've written books about this where people just simply argue back and forth. Well, no, this person's wrong, I'm right, blah, 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 and that happens quite a bit. This is one of her training slides, which I love, because it breaks down the incident command system into very pragmatic, simple language. And the point is that things like ICS and SEMS, the State Emergency Management System, and NIMS, the National Incident Management System, they are way less complicated and arcane than people make them out to be. They make it seem like you're learning something completely foreign and alien, and it's not. And part of it is the way it's presented, part of it is the way that people write it, the culture of the organizations that are promoting these programs, but it's not. And so Dr. Dorian just went out of her way to cut through that. The drill. 3 hours, school hours, children present. It was chaos. It was also fun. It was educational for everyone. And it was time well spent. This is a learn by doing thing. You can only sit through so many classes about it. And each school has only had one drill to this point. They have not yet had a second drill. A couple of them are scheduling. One scheduled and then canceled because of rain. That's another LA thing. So the point is that the basics really are basic. I think that actually says that on a different slide. None of this is rocket science. But if you're not familiar with it, and especially, it is a learn-by-doing thing. And there are some other specific issues regarding school-based transition to the disasters. Here are some of the children taken by my high-quality BlackBerry phone doing the drop-cover-hold-on drill. And luckily, these children happen to be all wearing identical shirts based on grade that day. I don't think that's normal. They do have some of the schools have uniforms. I don't want to say that the teachers had wind that this was coming down. They all knew it was going to happen. I have to go back on a random non-disaster day just to see if they're all wearing identical colored shirts. And here are teachers and teacher aides and office workers getting ready. And they are conducting an analysis of who's missing. The first critical step, of course, is attendance. And then after attendance, it's not just who's missing, but where might they be? Who is the last person to see them? Where would they normally be that time of day? Were they in the bathroom? Were they sent to the nurse? Etc. And so one of the key factors is keeping the rescuers safe, not putting the rescuers in harm's way, but only go looking for the people that you have to look for, and only go looking for them where you expect to find them. And it included everything, full scale. So sustaining it now involves things like replacing items when they expire or inventorying items, and a lot of them do have long shelf lives. Subsequent drills like we talked about, ongoing training for new staff, subsequent drills. The idea is to not make this a one-off event, but make this part of the culture. I do this a lot with communities, emergency and disaster preparedness and response and resilience. That's my area. But the thing is you don't want people to join something new, as in a disaster preparedness program. You want to take that knowledge and infuse it into the pre-existing social networks. The way people normally function on a given day, you want them to have that enhancement. You don't want them to come join a new program. That's a model that, well, I don't have the evidence in front of me right now, in front of us right now, but trust me. So, there were four schools spread across five campuses. As you can see, they were multi-grade or multi-level or however educational people describe that. Sorry. There were 650 students per school. That is a high student-to-adult ratio. Or, I'm sorry, low, I should say. Part of this is because the split campus had extra staff, obviously. And also, you have a lot of teacher aides, a lot of community members that are in and around the school that bump that up a little bit. There you see a summary of the hours that were required to at each school. Okay, we can't bring this from the outside. You know, while Dr. Dorian is of that community, we can't bring this from the outside, and we need someone at that school to be an advocate. And this is a combination of teachers and parents, and it depended on which school it was at and so forth. Each school had its own internal culture as well. But we really, really needed that buy-in to sustain it. The other thing, I can't understate this enough, everyone really knows everyone. And they've known each other for a very, very long time and know all the drama and all the stories. And again, that's both good and bad. You know, it's not a formal, structured relationship like in a public school, perhaps. This is generations of people knowing each other. The other thing, the supervisory relationships. This is the big, hard hurdle for transition to the incident command system. You have people who might be in a supervisory relationship 364 days a year, but then that one day of year where there's an emergency, a disaster, you have to flip that. And it's based upon some competencies. It's based upon some skill. There's some informal stuff. But we quickly learn that just because so-and-so might be the assistant vice principal or whatever their title might be, they're not really the right person for this particular ICS job function. And that took some negotiating. That was the hard part. There's a little bit more about that. The high school age children. This is something we also know about the behavior of children in disasters. They want to contribute. They want to play a role. They also have the physical capability to do so. The point, though, is, of course, that they're minors, so that there are legal issues. That's another fine line to dance sometimes, depending on who the audience is. But put them to work, even if it's help moving supplies, if it's, you know, setting up the pop-up canopies. There are things that the high school students want to do, and you should take advantage of that, not treat them as simply a dependent population. You can read the rest for yourselves, but what I really want to say, most disaster preparedness educational approaches, and this is something that bothers me, it's treated as a checklist format. Oh, you don't have a flashlight? Oh, you're clearly not prepared. And they go down the list of all the things someone should have or should do. When I give a community presentation, the most important thing I always emphasize is that what you need for a disaster does not fit in your kit. It's that person next to you. It's that person who cares about you, who you care about, who you can work with and cooperate with. That's the critical difference between success and failure. So the next time we do this, obviously, we want to measure it. We want to formalize and quantify. We do want to export this, but also we want to see, are there differences between schools and communities that have that tight social network versus, you know, an ordinary public school in any other given community? We want to see if that matters in a quantitative way, and we're not capable of doing that at this point. The Presbyterians, they were interested in and looked at the model, but for whatever reasons, they didn't choose to take it up at that time. But this is something that we can easily export. The key point, though, is that once you send it out to a school, they have to own it. They have to make it their own. And that's our contact info. So, you said that there would be questions after each, so I guess there's time for a couple. All right. Oh.
I'm just shocked that you were able to get the administrators to agree to 7.5 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, that would never happen in a public school.
Yeah.
So how do you think you could abbreviate it and try to sell it, or it wouldn't work if you had this 3 hours for you?
Well, there are a couple things. So it was modular. So you could do it like one session every quarter or something, or once a month, something like that. This can be spread out. They do have more flexibility with scheduling in the parochial school, and for the teacher training days, they would devote it to this. It wasn't 7.5 hours of continuous training. So you can break it down. Second, at least in California, and I don't want to speak for other places, but we do have disasters everywhere, small, medium, and large, they do have a little bit more formal training in their school orientation and such. So they're not completely new and naive to the concept. And also LAUSD, for example, offers pay incentives, and I think it's steps or something like that in terms of the seniority of the professor in terms of pay, professor, teacher. But the idea is that they do get a bump if they take disaster training on their own, such as the CERT training. Yes, sir?
Has this program been presented, I might overlook this, to the Department of Education or the Homeland Security?
Hasn't been presented to anybody at all. This is, you know, this was a truly homegrown, truly grassroots effort. I got pulled into it from the outside, and no one has seen this at all. So that's, you know, that's something to move towards. Yes, ma'am. To my knowledge, no. We did look at that, but it was very cursory. It was not super in-depth, but really the answer is no. And even if there is something on a web page somewhere, it's not in circulation and it's not being used. All right.
Thanks.